Welcome to Voices in Value-Based Care. I'm Matt Pugh, and thanks for tuning in. The movement to value-based care is revolutionizing how healthcare providers get reimbursed for delivery of care. On this program, we explore stories from the field about how real organizations are dealing with this change. You can follow the show on Twitter at #VoicesInVBC and follow SPH on Twitter at SPH Analytics. On the program today, I'm talking with Drew Ivan, Chief Product and Strategy Officer with Lineate. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
We are super excited to talk about which is, you know, one of the most important subjects in healthcare. It may not be the sexiest, but it's interoperability. But before we dive into that, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of your path to where you are?
As you mentioned in the introduction, I'm the Chief Product and Strategy Officer at Lineate, which means that I get to think about where we're at, where interoperability is going, and how we can sort of align our product roadmap to meet the industry where it's going to be at the time of our next releases. And the fun thing about that is we get to, you know, do a lot of exploration, a lot of tracking of trends and regulations. And it really gives a little bit of a crystal ball to see what the future is going to look like. So that's the exciting part of it. Lineate is an organization that's a little bit over a year old, but we were formed from the merger of two very seasoned products. The Rhapsody Integration Engine and CorePoint Health came together about a little over a year ago to form Lineate. And, you know, both of those products had been in the market for about 20 years. So we have a long legacy of working on healthcare interoperability problems. And, you know, we're best known for our products, which are integration engines that are primarily used in hospitals and similar organizations to move data between and among their clinical systems. But really, our focus is not as much on the products as it is on solving those interoperability problems, whether it happens within our product or next to our product or as a process that involves multiple products.
Excellent. And you've been working with Rhapsody for some time, right?
Yeah, I joined the organization that owned Rhapsody prior to it being spun off as its own company. I joined in 2008 and I've been working. And before that, I was a Rhapsody customer. So I have more experience with the product than I have with the organization even. So since about 2005, I've been working with the Rhapsody engine and HL7 and other healthcare integration standards. So that's enough time actually to see a number of different trends start to take off, mature, and in some cases even fade away. So it's been interesting to watch those as they occur and see which things we sort of hold on to as best practices and which ones we sort of prune from the bush and let go.
Excellent. Thank you. So love the long-term experience with it, which I think to your point, lets you see those trends, what was going to be the next best thing that didn't turn out to be that best thing and all the evolution over time. But on this subject, especially now, I think one place we need to start is the 21st Century Cures Act. So work in progress for a long time. Finally, the final rule came out earlier this year, later than people expected. If you could, one, tell us a little bit about the act itself as it pertains to interoperability, and then, you know, your feelings on the implications of the act.
Yeah, so the 21st Century Cures Act is actually a law that was passed by Congress at the end of 2016. And a good thing about it is that it had broad bipartisan support, which means that there's, you know, unlike the Affordable Care Act, you don't have a lot of divisiveness around it. I mean, pretty much everyone is on board with what's in the Cures Act, and it's pretty big. I mean, there's a lot in there, and it provides funding and strategic direction for healthcare in the U.S. probably for a 10-year time frame at least. And to get some appreciation of how long-term the thinking is in the 21st Century Cures Act, you know, it was passed in December of 2016, and the interoperability rules that you're talking about were just finalized in March of 2020. So it took 3.5 years to put enough detail into the ONC and CMS rules to make them actionable. Like I said, there is a lot in the Cures Act, and one part of it has to do with patient access interoperability and information blocking, or more accurately, prevention against information blocking. Because after the Meaningful Use Program drove adoption of electronic health records throughout the U.S., there was sort of a built-in assumption that the interoperability would come for free. You know, once the data was off of paper and into an electronic format, you know, obviously that makes it easy to exchange, right? But it turned out that the amount of information being exchanged was pretty small. And part of it was due to either the real or perceived blocking of information, either from technology vendors or from the data holders themselves, the hospitals, the providers that held these records, were preventing them from being effectively transferred in accordance with the patient's wishes.
A lot of that for the reason that it was viewed as a valuable asset, right? And competition reasons, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you can sort of take either approach when you have data. You can either treat the data as, a valuable asset that you want to protect and you don't want to share, because if someone else gets a hold of your data, they could use it in a way that's either, directed against you, or, in a way that's more clever than you. By which I mean, if you're a hospital and you have a patient's record, in your EMR, that makes the patient pretty sticky to that hospital system, because if they go to another hospital, then the doctor doesn't have their records. There's a lot of rework to build up that medical history. And, instead of going through that pain, the patient, would rather just stick with the hospital that they that they're familiar with. So by mandating that the data can flow in accordance with the patient's wishes, that sort of creates a competitive problem for that hospital. The other problem that it introduces is, once you have all this data stored electronically, and now we have over 10 years worth of it, that's starting to get to be a substantial amount of data that you can run analytics on, or machine learning or artificial intelligence, and start to draw interesting conclusions or detect patterns or come to insights that are useful for improving your care of the patients and your business outcomes. If that data gets into somebody else's hands, maybe they come up with those insights and they can use them instead of you. So, for those reasons, you can see why it's natural for someone who has the data not to want to let it go. The other approach you can take to data is to turn it into, a pre-competitive table stakes type of scenario where you say, we generated the data, but we're going to share it with anybody who has a right to it. And we're going to compete on the quality of our care rather than our access to this specific data that we generated. And then you have everything in between, from the data hoarders to the data liberators. There's every possibility in between. And I think what the ONC and CMS rules are saying is, it's the government saying through, the main tool that they have, which is regulation and funding, is they're saying that the amount of interoperability is too close to the data hoarding end of the spectrum. And we're not going to go so far as to say everybody has to share all data all the time. But we do want to turn the dial from zero up to, 2 or 3 instead of all the way to 10. So it's a direction from the federal government that says, we think that there's value in more openness rather than more hoarding of data. And, this is a way to promote that.
And the act itself is not just for providers, right? It also impacts the payer side. So it's really trying to unlock data in kind of the whole ecosystem. It's not just focused on those that have had EHRs, let's say.
Yeah, so the information blocking provision of the 21st Century Cures Act, which is realized through these ONC and CMS rules, pertains to providers, payers, and information technology vendors. And there's something in there for all of them. It says, here's some compliance issues that you have to undertake in order to not be subject to the penalties that come with information blocking, right? So that's the carrot and stick approach. They've said that the stick is, if you are found to be information blocking, you're subject to penalties. And the carrot is, some of these are conditions of participation in CMS. So in order to get reimbursed from CMS, providers and payers will have to comply with these rules. And so that provides a strong motivation for them to get on board with the rules.
Absolutely. And it'll be very interesting once the data really starts flowing, what that unlocks from a, you know, innovation perspective and everything else, as you said, right? What can you learn from all this data? Just as also from a healthcare consumer, myself and yourself and family, and how frustrating it can be when you have to answer the same set of questions over and over. And if you don't write your own notes and everything, and you go to the next doctor, you know, we're all kind of starting from scratch. So I'm definitely excited to see that data start flowing for professional and personal reasons. Speaking of that, the standards, let's say, and one of those being FHIR. So anybody that's been in health IT for any amount of time has heard about FHIR. Seems like it's kind of been out there talked about as that new thing for years and years and years now, right? So would love to get your perspective on FHIR, where we're at today and the impact over the next few years.
Yeah, that's right. The rules specify a specific version of FHIR that has to be used, which is kind of rare that not only a specific technology, a specific data standard, but also a specific version it's rare to see those specified in a federal law or federal rule.
Right. I didn't even realize they were calling out a specific version. That's interesting.
Yeah, version 4.0. So that's unusual. But what it does actually is, you know, it constrains the implementation to something very specific. So you won't even be able to use the excuse for blocking information that I did comply with the rule, I just didn't use the same version as somebody else who's trying to pick up the data. I mean, it really puts a strong boundary around what they're prescribing so that there's little little ability to misinterpret or differently interpret the rules among the different parties. FHIR is, like you say, it's a newer standard, a newer technology, but it is heavily informed by the standards that came before it. Which is to say, we took a lot of the lessons learned from HL7 version 2, CCD and CCDA, you know, just a lot of those previous generations of integration standards. FHIR is, in a way, a reaction to them. It builds on the best parts of it and diverges from the parts that weren't working so well. I think the important thing to realize about FHIR APIs that it's not going to replace the existing older standards. It's going to exist alongside them as a new tool in the toolbox. So now instead of having just, you know, three or four ways to exchange data, we're going to have this fifth one that has different pluses and minuses. And I think that's important because the different standards are good at different things. And, you know, all of those patterns are still in use in healthcare. For example, Health HL7 version 2 is really good at pushing information about real-world events from one system to another. You know, a patient gets admitted to the emergency room, and that real-world event is modeled as a packet of data, which can then be sent to all the systems that need to know about that admission. That's harder to do in FHIR. It's not impossible, but HL7 is so good at it and so optimized for it that why would you replace it? I mean, all those interfaces are already built. They're well optimized for what they do. You know, instead of replacing those with FHIR or implementing new systems using FHIR instead of HL7, why not just stick with what's working really well? So I think that, as is often the case, when we introduce a new standard, it doesn't sunset the old one as much as it does provide new capabilities that we didn't have before. And so now that broadens the tool set that we have. It also, you know, means that, you know, the integration analysts and engineers have to, you know, add that skill to their resume in order to get their job done.
Makes sense. And it's interesting. I didn't realize it was going to be sitting next to. I thought it was much more of a rip and replace with FHIR. So that's good to know and probably put some people at ease a little bit there. So, you know, interoperability has so often been really about, or at least in the general discussions framework, about data from one EHR to another EHR, right? Usually competing EHRs or competing systems or providers. But is that the scope we should be thinking of, right? Because when you start thinking about all the data that we've collected, not just in EHRs, but the proliferation of everything else, right? Care management systems and population health and PM and just to name a few, let alone everything else, it feels a little bit of a tight scope. So curious on your thoughts, what do we really need to be successful? What is the scope of interoperability to be successful?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, it's not a bad description to say that interoperability is fundamentally getting data into and out of EHRs, because that is the central system, the central software system in any hospital or any healthcare setting. But to my way of thinking, and the way a lot of our customers are thinking, the EHR is the organization's official legal medical record of encounters between patients and providers. Mm-hmm. And it's used to generate bills. It's used to deliver healthcare in the future. It's used to document everything that has happened between that organization and a patient. But it is focused very much on one organization, and it's organized around patients. And there's a lot more to healthcare than those two ways of looking at things. From the patient perspective, they get care from many different organizations. They see a number of different specialists who may or may not be affiliated with the same hospital system. They move around the country and around the world and get healthcare in different settings. You know, there's also different kinds of non-healthcare wellness events that you want to document. Right. So, those might not exist in any such system at all. You know, so you have this broad landscape of different sources of data. And you also have, different types of data, even within that one organization, even within one hospital, there's more than just the EMR. A lot of data is generated and resides in ancillary systems like laboratory and radiology systems. A lot of it is in secondary systems, systems of engagement like case management or population health systems. Right. But then there's also like administrative systems. There's billing systems, there's logistics systems. And, once you start taking your focus off individual patients and onto entire populations or onto entire operations within an organization, you might want those systems to be able to talk together. And, a lot of those systems are already talking using APIs, which are probably not FHIR if they're not clinical systems, but they're an API nonetheless. And therefore, an API style of integration starts to make sense as you need to, let's say, move data from your EMR into your case management system or into a CRM because you want to be able to follow up with those customers. And at the same time, you want to be able to update your inventory after every procedure. So your EMR, when it sends a bill to the insurance company, it also sends a notification to your inventory management system that, certain supplies have been used. So these are all new styles of integration that had never been possible before when the focus was on siloed EMRs with very narrow clinical interfaces coming in and out of them.
And do the portions of that 21st Century Cures Act to deal with IT vendors also cover those peripheral, pop health, case management, care management? Are they also under the, carrot and stick model of the 21st Century Cures Act?
I'm not sure. I'm not a lawyer, so don't quote me on this. I think it applies to any vendor who has been certified for the Meaningful Use Program or its successor program, which is called Promoting Interoperability. So I think it applies to just certified software.
So that tees up my next question, which is, COVID probably put a little bit more of a light on it, just because of, who it's impacting the most is the older population. But post-acute, home health care, right, all of that data that's out there, and especially as value-based care drives more and more get out of the hospital in acute setting, right, as fast as you can, and keep people out as much as you can. That post-acute and home health space is really a lot of opportunity for reduction of cost, improvement of quality, right, stopping admissions, readmissions. Where do they fit into this interoperability space? Or are they kind of on the outside right now?
Well, I mean, for a long time, they've been sort of left out of the participation. A common pattern would be a patient would have a hospital visit, an inpatient stay, and then they would get discharged to a long-term care facility or some type of rehabilitation program, but their data wouldn't follow them. So the care plan that the doctors put together in the hospital, they probably printed it out and handed it to the patient and said, be sure to take this to physical therapy with you.
Right.
But, the patient should never be the interface, right? So if that paper doesn't make it to the follow-up appointment, That new doctor now has a harder job. They have to ask the patient what's going on. They may have to make a phone call. That introduces a tremendous amount of drag on the system. And by just sort of letting them participate in the process, it really improves the continuity of care across different settings. And we're starting to see more and more non-acute settings start to participate in the interoperability game, which is great because, you know, every increment of interoperability that you can introduce across a broader and broader ecosystem is less data that has to be transferred manually or brought through by the patient. And it improves care for those patients. And you're right that COVID has sort of put a light on that because, you know, there's another dimension of interoperability, which is that a lot of what happens in the healthcare system needs to be aggregated and reported to the public health system. And public health and healthcare are not the same system, right. But they do interface through the same standards. So all those laboratory results for positive COVID cases mm-hmm. get sent using the same HL7 message that the lab uses to send the result back to the EMR. It's sending the same lab result in the same format to the public health department. Which then takes that data and turns it into a case report, which can be followed up with contact tracing or some kind of management, or, you know, all those dashboards that you see of the COVID cases come from the case management systems at public health departments, which, is rolled up lab results and case reports from hospitals and laboratories in the jurisdiction. So that interoperability, has a really global impact on all dimensions of the healthcare system.
Yeah, and hoping that we take a negative here with COVID and turn it into a positive and accelerate some of these things. And it'll be curious to see if it starts changing some. Consumerism was a big buzzword. Feels literally decade plus ago,
yeah.
But start acting more from a consumer base. And when you're looking at these facilities, hey, is there data exchange, right? And that sort of stuff. So it'll be interesting to see if good old fashioned competition starts driving some interoperability as opposed to just the classic stick model that always seems to need to be in place by CMS to drive certain things. So interested to see what happens there, which then leads to my next question, which is, where do you think that interoperability is, and we'll make it really crystal ballish here, 5 years out and 10 years out. So we're talking, about 2025 and 2030. Love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. And before I answer that question, though, I wanted to follow up on your last statement there about competition. We're seeing that among our customers already. They are starting to differentiate based on patient experience rather than on holding that patient's records. And so you're seeing a lot of improved hospital rooms, a lot of entertainment systems are being put into the rooms, upgraded food ordering systems. And the interesting thing about this is, you think of it as a smart TV in the room improves the patient experience. That's true. But it also has a clinical dimension because the television knows when the patient is supposed to get meds and yep. what their orders are. So that means that the TV has to be interfaced to the EMR, which is something that you wouldn't think of. That's a driver of interoperability that indirectly came out of the information blocking rules, because take away information blocking, you have to compete on patient experience, which drives more interoperability. So that was something I didn't see coming. And so that's why I want to say that my vision 5 and 10 years in the future might not be that clear. But I think if you want to see what interoperability is, how much will it change in 5 and 10 years, we can look backwards 5 and 10 years and see that it really hasn't changed that much from 10 years ago. Like I said before, we're not really retiring any of the ways we used to do interoperability. Even though we are introducing new and more capable patterns, we're not getting rid of the old ones. So I think everything we have today is likely to remain in place in 5 and 10 years. We will have broader adoption of FHIR. That one's easy to predict because it's underway right now, and there are specific deadlines in the rules that say, 12 and 24 months out, they have to be implemented. So for sure, within 5 years, those will be implemented and widely adopted. But the thing that's going to be harder to predict, even in the 5-year timeframe, is what are the cool applications that can be built on this new layer of interoperability infrastructure that right. was not previously available. Because I think what APIs do is they align the integration effort better with the stakeholder who most wants the integration to happen. Which exactly what I mean is, in the old days, in the HL7 version 2 days, which is actually the present, if an app developer had an idea for a great application that was going to improve patient care, but it relied on data from the EMR, the app developer's only recourse was to go to the hospital system that had that data and say, I'd like to build an HL7 interface to your EMR. And then you had all the barriers of the legal access to the data, plus right. you had the IT bottleneck. And then once you started the IT project, there's quite a lot of negotiation about exactly what version of the standard will we use, what messages will we exchange, you know, exactly what do they look like, what's the data in each field, what code sets are you using. It might take you 6 months to get the project started and another 6 months to get it finished. So implementations became, you know, very long. With APIs, what the model is, the data holder will publish an API specification that says exactly what the API looks like, exactly what data is delivered and in what format, and they make it basically public. And so any application developer that wants to get that data, you know, they might have to do all the work on their side, but there's no question of what work to do. They can, with no communication at all with the data holder, they can build an application that accesses that data. And then when they're ready to turn on the interface, they make the call to the information holder and, you know, do the legal agreement and everything else. And it puts the work of building the interface on the guy who wants the data and doesn't involve, you know, the data holder in that project. Because right. that doesn't scale for the data holder. If they have 100 app developers that they have to work with, you know, they can't staff for that. Yeah. But what they can do is publish one API one time and let those 100 developers each pick it up and do the work against it.
And I'm excited to see, as we all are, you know, once you unlock that and you let people just be creative and find things like you just mentioned with the TV that, you know, nobody sees coming while somebody thinks about it, and it's going to be good. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you again for joining us, Drew. Thanks for the audience for tuning in. Been a great session, great discussion. You know, time boxing is always a little challenge. I could go much longer with you, but maybe we'll get you to come back for an update in the future.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. You can learn more about the show on the programs page on healthcarenowradio.com and lend your voice to the conversation on Twitter at #VoicesInDBC. Be sure to follow SPH on Twitter at SPH Analytics. And of course, you can always connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm Matt Fusen, bringing you voices in value-based care you should hear. Until next time, have a great week.